Latest innovations is a ramshackle cross between a hen house and a prairie schooner. Housing 400 laying hens, this rickety old covered wagon has hinged nesting boxes lined up like saddlebags on either side, allowing someone to retrieve eggs from the outside. I'd first laid eyes on the eggmobile the night before, parked a couple of paddocks away from the cattle herd. The hens had already climbed the little ramp into the safety of the coop for the night, and before we went down to dinner, Joel had latched the trap door behind them. Now it was time to move them into a fresh paddock, and Joel was bolting the eggmobile to the hitch of his tractor. It wasn't quite 7 a.m. yet, but Joel seemed delighted to have someone to talk to, holding forth being one of his greatest pleasures. "In nature, you'll always find birds following herbivores," Joel explained when I asked him for the theory behind the eggmobile. "The egret perched on the rhino's nose, the pheasants and turkeys trailing after the bison. That's a symbiotic relationship we're trying to imitate. In each case, the birds dine on the insects that would otherwise bother the herbivore. They also pick insect larvae and parasites out of the animal's droppings, breaking the cycle of infestation and disease. To mimic this symbiosis on a domestic scale, we follow the cattle in their rotation with the eggmobile. I call these gals our sanitation crew." Joel climbed onto the tractor, threw it into gear, and slowly towed the rickety contraption 50 yards or so across the meadow to a paddock the cattle had vacated 3 days earlier. It seems the chickens eschew fresh manure, so he waits 3 or 4 days before bringing them in, but not a day longer. "That's because the fly larvae in the manure are on a 4-day cycle," he explained. 3 days is ideal. That gives the grubs a chance to fatten up nicely, the way the hens like them, but not quite long enough to hatch into flies. The result is prodigious amounts of protein for the hens, the insects supplying as much as a third of their total diet, and making their eggs unusually rich and tasty. By means of this simple little management trick, Joel is able to use his cattle's waste to grow large quantities of high-protein chicken feed for free. He says this trims his cost of producing eggs by 25 cents per dozen. Very much his accountant father's son, Joel can tell you the exact economic implication of every synergy on the farm. The cows further oblige the chickens by shearing the grass. Chickens can't navigate in grass more than about 6 inches tall. After Joel had maneuvered the eggmobile into position, he opened the trap door, and an eager, gossipy procession of barred rocks, Rhode Island reds, and New Hampshire whites filed down the little ramp, fanning out across the pasture. The hens picked at the grasses, especially the clover, but mainly they were all over the cowpaths, doing this frantic, backward-stepping breakdance with their claws to scratch apart the caked manure and expose the meaty morsels within. Unfolding here before us, I realized, was a most impressive form of alchemy. Cow patties in the process of being transformed into exceptionally tasty eggs. I'm convinced an eggmobile would be worth it even if the chickens never laid a single egg. These birds do a more effective job of sanitizing a pasture than anything human, mechanical, or chemical, and the chickens love doing it. Because of the eggmobile, Joel doesn't have to run his cattle through a headgate to slather ivermectin, a systemic parasiticide, on their hides or worm them with toxic chemicals. This is what Joel means when he says the animals do the real work around here. "I'm just the orchestra conductor, making sure everybody's in the right place at the right time." That day, my second on the farm, as Joel introduced me to each of his intricately layered enterprises, I began to understand just how radically different this sort of farming is from the industrial modes I'd observed before, whether in an Iowa cornfield or an organic chicken farm in California. Indeed, it is so different that I found Polyface's system difficult to describe to myself in an orderly way. Industrial processes follow a clear, linear, hierarchical logic that is fairly easy to put into words, probably because words follow a similar logic. First this, then that. Put this in here, and then out comes that. But the relationship between cows and chickens on this farm, leaving aside for the moment the other creatures and relationships present here, takes the form of a loop rather than a line, and that makes it hard to know where to start, or how to distinguish between causes and effects, subjects and objects. Is what I'm looking at in this pasture a system for producing exceptionally tasty eggs? If so, then the cattle and their manure are a means to an end. Or is it a system for producing grass-fed beef without the use of any chemicals, in which case the chickens, by fertilizing and sanitizing the cow pastures, comprise the means to that end? So does that make their eggs a product or a byproduct? And is manure, theirs or the cattle's, a waste product or a raw material? And what should we call the fly larvae? Depending on the point of view you take, that of the chicken, cow, or even the grass, the relationship between subject and object, cause and effect, flips. Joel would say this is precisely the point, and precisely the distinction between a biological and industrial system. In an ecological system like this, everything's connected to everything else, so you can't change one thing without changing 10 other things. Take the issue of scale. I could sell a whole lot more chickens and eggs than I do. They're my most profitable items, and the market is telling me to produce more of them. Operating under the industrial paradigm, I could boost production however much I wanted. Just buy more chicks and more feed. Crank up that machine. But in a biological system, you can never do just one thing, and I couldn't add many more chickens without messing up something else. Here's an example. This pasture can absorb 400 units of nitrogen a year. That translates into 4 visits from the eggmobile or 2 passes of a broiler pen. If I ran any more eggmobiles or broiler pens over it, the chickens would put down more nitrogen than the grass could metabolize. Whatever the grass couldn't absorb would run off, and suddenly I have a pollution problem. Quality would suffer too. Unless he added more cattle to produce more grubs for the chickens and to keep the grass short enough for them to eat it, those chickens and eggs would not taste nearly as good as they do. It's all connected. This farm is more like an organism than a machine, and like any organism, it has its proper scale. A mouse is the size of a mouse for a good reason, and a mouse that was the size of an elephant wouldn't do very well. Joel likes to quote from an old agricultural textbook he dug out of the stacks at Virginia Tech many years ago. The book, which was published in 1941 by a Cornell ag professor, offers a stark conclusion that, depending on your point of view, will sound either hopelessly quaint or arresting in its gnomic wisdom. Farming is not adapted to large-scale operations because of the following reasons. Farming is concerned with plants and animals that live, grow, and die. Efficiency is the term usually invoked to defend large-scale industrial farms, and it usually refers to the economies of scale that can be achieved by the application of technology and standardization. Yet Joel Salatin's farm makes the case for a very different sort of efficiency, the one found in natural systems with their co-evolutionary relationships and reciprocal loops. For example, in nature there is no such thing as a waste problem, since one creature's waste becomes another creature's lunch. What could be more efficient than turning cow pies into eggs? Or running a half dozen different production systems, cows, broilers, layers, pigs, turkeys, over the same piece of ground every year? Most of the efficiencies in an industrial system are achieved through simplification, doing lots of the same thing over and over. In agriculture, this usually means a monoculture of a single animal or crop. In fact, the whole history of agriculture is a progressive history of simplification, as humans reduced the biodiversity of their landscapes to a small handful of chosen species. Wes Jackson calls our species Homo the homogenizer. With the industrialization of agriculture, the simplifying process reached its logical extreme, in monoculture. This radical specialization permitted standardization and mechanization, leading to the leaps in efficiency claimed by industrial agriculture. Of course, how you choose to measure efficiency makes all the difference, and industrial agriculture measures it simply by the yield of one chosen species per acre of land or farmer. By contrast, the efficiencies of natural systems flow from complexity and interdependence. By definition, the very opposite of simplification. To achieve the efficiency represented by turning cow manure into chicken eggs and producing beef without chemicals, you need at least two species, cows and chickens, but actually several more as well, including the larvae in the manure and the grasses in the pasture and the bacteria in the cow's rumens. To measure the efficiency of such a complex system, you need to count not only all the products it produces, meat, chicken, eggs, but also all the costs it eliminates, antibiotics, wormers, parasiticides, and fertilizers. Polyface farm is built on the efficiencies that come from mimicking relationships found in nature and layering one farm enterprise over another on the same base of land. In effect, Joel is farming in time as well as in space, in four dimensions rather than three. He calls this intricate layering stacking and points out that it is exactly the model God used in building nature. The idea is not to slightly imitate nature, but to model a natural ecosystem in all its diversity and interdependence, one where all the species fully express their physiological distinctiveness. He takes advantage of each species' natural proclivities in a way that not only benefits that animal, but other species as well. So instead of treating the chicken as a simple egg or protein machine, Polyface honors and exploits the innate distinctive desires of a chicken, which include pecking in the grass and cleaning up after herbivores. The chickens get to do and eat what they evolved to do and eat, and in the process, the farmer and his cattle both profit. What is the opposite of zero sum? I'm not sure, but this is it. Joel calls each of his stacked farm enterprises a holon, a word I'd never encountered before. He told me he picked it up from Allen Nation. When I asked Nation about it, he pointed me to Arthur Koestler, who coined the term in The Ghost in the Machine. Koestler felt English lacked a word to express the complex relationship of parts and wholes in a biological or social system. A holon, from the Greek holos, or whole, and the suffix on, as in proton, suggesting a particle, is an entity that from one perspective appears a self-contained whole, and from another, a dependent part. A body organ like the liver is a holon, so is an eggmobile. At any given time, Polyface has a dozen or more holons up and running, and on my second day, Joel and Daniel introduced me to a handful of them. I visited the Racken House, the former tool shed where Daniel has been raising rabbits for the restaurant trade since he was 10. Racken? Half rabbit, half chicken, Daniel explained. When the rabbits aren't out on the pasture in portable hutches, they live in cages suspended over a deep bedding of wood chips, in which I watched several dozen hens avidly pecking away in search of earthworms. Daniel explained that the big problem in raising rabbits indoors is their powerful urine, which produces so much ammonia that it scars their lungs and leaves them vulnerable to infection. To cope with the problem, most rabbit farmers add antibiotics to their feed. But the scratching of the hens turns the nitrogenous rabbit pee into the carbonaceous bedding, creating a rich compost teeming with earthworms that feed the hens. Drugs become unnecessary, and considering how many rabbits and chickens lived in it, the air in the Racken was, well, tolerable. Believe me, Daniel said, if it weren't for these chickens, you'd be gagging right about now, and your eyes would sting something awful. Before lunch, I helped Galen and Peter move the turkeys, another holon. Moving the turkeys, which happens every 3 days, means setting up a new feather net, a paddock outlined by portable electric fencing so lightweight I could carry and lay out the entire thing by myself, and then wean into it the shade mobile, called the Gobbledygo. Turk-turk-turk-rass-rass-rass-go-go by day and roost of it at night. They happily follow ocean into the fresh pasture to feast on the grass, which they seem to enjoy even more than the chickens do. A turkey consumes a long blade of grass by neatly folding it over and over again with its beak, as if making origami. Joel likes to run his turkeys in the orchard, where they eat the bugs, mow the grass, and fertilize the trees and vines. Turkeys will eat much more grass than chickens, and they don't damage crops the way chickens can. If you run turkeys in a grape orchard, Joel explained, you can afford to stock the birds at only 70% of normal density and space the vines at 70% of what's standard because you're getting two crops off the same land. And at 70%, you get much healthier birds and grapevines than you would at 100%. That's the beauty of stacking. By industry standards, the turkey and grape holon are each less than 100% efficient. Together, however, they produce more than either enterprise would yield if fully stocked, and they do so without fertilizer, weeding, or pesticide. I had witnessed one of the most winning examples of stacking in the cattle barn during my visit to Polyface back in March. The barn is an unfancy, open-sided structure where the cattle spend 3 months during the winter, each day consuming 25 pounds of hay and producing 50 pounds of manure. Water makes up the difference. But instead of regularly mucking out the barn, Joel leaves the manure in place, every few days covering it with another layer of wood chips or straw. As this layer cake of manure, wood chips, and straw gradually rises beneath the cattle, Joel simply raises the adjustable feed gate from which they get their ration of hay. By winter's end, the bedding and the cattle can be as much as 3 feet off the ground. There's one more secret ingredient Joel adds to each layer of this cake, a few bucketfuls of corn. All winter long, the layered bedding composts, in the process generating heat to warm the barn, thus reducing the animals' feed requirements and fermenting the corn. Joel calls it his cattle's electric blanket. Why the corn? Because there's nothing a pig enjoys more than 40-proof corn, and there's nothing he's better equipped to do than root it out with his powerful snout and exquisite sense of smell. I call them my pig aerators, Salatin said proudly as he showed me into the barn. As soon as the cows head out to pasture in the spring, several dozen pigs come in, proceeding systematically to turn and aerate the compost in their quest for kernels of alcoholic corn. What had been an anaerobic decomposition suddenly turns aerobic, which dramatically heats and speeds up the process, killing any pathogens. The result, after a few weeks of pig aerating, is a rich, cakey compost ready to use. This is the sort of farm machinery I like. Never needs its oil changed, appreciates over time, and when you're done with it, you eat it. We were sitting on the rail of a wooden paddock, watching the pigs do their thing. A thing, of course, we weren't having to do ourselves. The line about the pig aerators was obviously well worn. But the cliché that kept banging around in my head was happy as a pig in shit. Buried clear to their butts in composting manure, a bobbing sea of wriggling hams and corkscrew tails, these were the happiest pigs I'd ever seen. I couldn't look at their spiraled tails, which cruised above the earthy mass like conning towers on submarines, without thinking about the fate of pigtails in industrial hog production. Simply put, there are no pigtails in industrial hog production. Farmers dock or snip off the tails at birth, a practice that makes a certain twisted sense if you follow the logic of industrial efficiency on a hog farm. Piglets in these CAFOs are weaned from their mothers 10 days after birth, compared with 13 weeks in nature, because they gain weight faster on their drug-fortified feed than on sow's milk. But this premature weaning leaves the pigs with a lifelong craving to suck and chew, a need they gratify in confinement by biting the tail of the animal in front of them. A normal pig would fight off his molester, but a demoralized pig has stopped caring. Learned helplessness is the psychological term, and it's not uncommon in CAFOs, where tens of thousands of hogs spend their entire lives ignorant of earth or straw or sunshine, crowded together beneath a metal roof standing on metal slats suspended over a septic tank. It's not surprising that an animal as intelligent as a pig would get depressed under these circumstances, and a depressed pig will allow his tail to be chewed on to the point of infection. Since treating sick pigs is not economically efficient, these underperforming production units are typically clubbed to death on the spot. Tail docking is the USDA's recommended solution to the porcine vice of tail chewing. Using a pair of pliers and no anesthetic, most, but not quite all, of the tail is snipped off. Why leave the little stump? Because the whole point of the exercise is not to remove the object of tail biting so much as to render it even more sensitive. Now a bite to the tail is so painful that even the most demoralized pig will struggle to resist it. Horrible as it is to contemplate, it's not hard to see how the road to such a hog hell is smoothly paved with the logic of industrial efficiency. A very different concept of efficiency sponsors the hog heaven on display here in Salatin's barn, one predicated on what he calls the pigness of the pig. These pigs, too, were being exploited, in this case, tricked into making compost as well as pork. What distinguishes Salatin's system is that it is designed around the natural predilections of the pig rather than around the requirements of a production system to which the pigs are then conformed. Pig happiness is simply the byproduct of treating pigs as pigs rather than as a protein machine with flaws. Flaws such as pigtails and a tendency, when immiserated, to get stressed. Salatin reached down deep where his pigs were happily rooting and brought a handful of fresh compost right up to my nose. What had been cow manure and wood chips just a few weeks before now smelled as sweet and warm as the forest floor in summertime, a miracle of transubstantiation. As soon as the pigs complete their alchemy, Joel will spread the compost on his pastures. There it will feed the grasses, so the grasses might again feed the cows the chickens, and so on till the snow falls, in one long, beautiful, and utterly convincing proof that in a world where grass can eat sunlight and food animals can eat grass, there is indeed a free lunch. Tuesday afternoon. After our own quick lunch, ham salad and deviled eggs, Joel and I drove to town in his pickup to make a delivery and take care of a few errands. It felt sweet to be sitting down for a while, especially after a morning taken up with loading the hay we'd baled the day before into the hayloft. For me, this rather harrowing operation involved attempting to catch 50-pound bales that Galen tossed in my general direction from the top of the hay wagon. The ones that didn't completely knock me over, I hoisted onto a conveyor belt that carried them to Daniel and Peter, stationed up in the hayloft. It was an assembly line, more or less, and as soon as I fell behind, or just fell, literally, the hay bales piled up fast at my station. I felt like Lucille Ball at the candy factory. I joked to Joel that, contrary to his claims that the animals did most of the real work on this farm, it seemed to me they'd left plenty of it for us. On a farm, complexity sounds an awful lot like hard work, Joel's claims to the contrary notwithstanding. As much work as the animals do, that's still us humans out there moving the cattle every evening, dragging the broiler pens across the field before breakfast, something I'd pledged I'd wake up in time for the next day, and towing chicken coops hither and yon according to a schedule tied to the life cycle of fly larvae and the nitrogen load of chicken manure. My guess is that there aren't too many farmers today who are up for either the physical or mental challenge of this sort of farming, not when industrializing promises to simplify the job. Indeed, a large part of the appeal of industrial farming is its panoply of labor and thought-saving devices. Machines of every description to do the physical work, and chemicals to keep crops and animals free from pests with scarcely a thought from the farmer. George Naylor works his fields maybe 50 days out of the year. Joel and Daniel and two interns are out there every day, sunrise to sunset, for a good chunk of the year. Yet Joel and Daniel plainly relish their work, partly because it is so varied from day to day and even hour to hour, and partly because they find it endlessly interesting. Wendell Berry has written eloquently about the intellectual work that goes into farming well, especially into solving the novel problems that inevitably crop up in a natural system as complex as a farm. You don't see much of this sort of problem-solving in agriculture today, not when so many solutions come ready-made in plastic bottles. So much of the intelligence and local knowledge in agriculture has been removed from the farm to the laboratory, and then returned to the farm in the form of a chemical or machine. "Whose head is the farmer using?" Berry asks in one of his essays. Whose head is using the farmer? Part of the problem is you've got a lot of D students left on the farm today, Joel said, as we drove around Staunton running errands. The guidance counselors encouraged all the A students to leave home and go to college. There's been a tremendous brain drain in rural America. Of course, that suits Wall Street just fine. Wall Street is always trying to extract brain power and capital from the countryside. First, they take the brightest bulbs off the farm and put them to work in Dilbert's cubicle, and then they go after the capital of the dimmer ones who stayed behind by selling them a bunch of gee-whiz solutions to their problems. This isn't just the farmer's problem, either. It's a foolish culture that entrusts its food supply to simpletons. It isn't hard to see why there isn't much institutional support for the sort of low-capital, thought-intensive farming Joel Salatin practices. He buys next to nothing. When a livestock farmer is willing to practice complexity, to choreograph the symbiosis of several different animals, each of which has been allowed to behave and eat as they evolved to, he will find he has little need for machinery, fertilizer, and, most strikingly, chemicals. He finds he has no sanitation problem or any of the diseases that result from raising a single animal in a crowded monoculture and then feeding it things it wasn't designed to eat. This is perhaps the greatest efficiency of a farm treated as a biological system. Health. I was struck by the fact that for Joel, abjuring agrochemicals and pharmaceuticals is not so much a goal of his farming, as it so often is in organic agriculture, as it is an indication that his farm is functioning well. In nature, health is the default, he pointed out. Most of the time, pests and disease are just nature's way of telling the farmer he's doing something wrong. At Polyface, no one ever told me not to touch the animals or asked me to put on a biohazard suit before going into the brooder house. The reason I had to wear one at Petaluma Poultry is because that system, a monoculture of chickens raised in close confinement, is inherently precarious, and the organic rules prohibition on antibiotics puts it at a serious disadvantage. Maintaining a single-species animal farm on an industrial scale isn't easy without pharmaceuticals and pesticides. Indeed, that's why these chemicals were invented in the first place, to keep shaky monocultures from collapsing. Sometimes the large-scale organic farmer looks like someone trying to practice industrial agriculture with one hand tied behind his back. By the same token, a reliance on agrochemicals destroys the information feedback loop on which an attentive farmer depends to improve his farming. Meds just mask genetic weaknesses, Joel explained one afternoon when we were moving the cattle. My goal is always to improve the herd, adapt it to the local conditions by careful culling. To do this, I need to know who has a propensity for pink eye, for worms. You simply have no clue if you're giving meds all the time. So you tell me, who's really in this so-called information economy? Those who learn from what they observe on their farm, or those who rely on concoctions from the devil's pantry? End of Disc 7. Of course, the simplest, most traditional measure of a farm's efficiency is how much food it produces per unit of land. By this yardstick, too, Polyface is impressively efficient. I asked Joel how much food Polyface produces in a season, and he rattled off the following figures. 30,000 dozen eggs, 10,000 broilers, 800 stewing hens, 50 beeves, representing 25,000 pounds of beef, 250 hogs, 25,000 pounds of pork, 1,000 turkeys, 500 rabbits. This seemed to me a truly astonishing amount of food from 100 acres of grass. But when I put it that way to Joel that afternoon, we were riding the ATV up to the very top of the hill to visit the hogs in their summer quarters, he questioned my accounting method. It was far too simple. Sure, you can write that we produced all that food from 100 open acres, but if you really want to be accurate about it, then you've got to count the 450 acres of woodlot, too. I didn't get that at all. I knew the woodlot was an important source of farm income in the winter. Joel and Daniel operate a small sawmill from which they sell lumber and mill whatever wood they need to build sheds and barns, and Daniel's new house. But what in the world did the forest have to do with producing food? Joel proceeded to count the ways. Most obviously, the farm's water supply depended on its forests to hold moisture and prevent erosion. Many of the farm's streams and ponds would simply dry up if not for the cover of trees. Nearly all of the farm's 550 acres had been deforested when the Salatins arrived. One of the first things Bill Salatin did was plant trees on all the north-facing slopes.
"Feel how cool it is in here." We were passing through a dense stand of oak and hickory. "Those deciduous trees work like an air conditioner. That reduces the stress on the animals in summer."
Suddenly we arrived at a patch of woodland that looked more like a savanna than a forest. The trees had been thinned, and all around them grew thick grasses. This was one of the big paddocks that Joel had carved out of the woods with the help of the pigs themselves. "All we do to make a new pig paddock is fence off a quarter acre of forest, thin out the saplings to let in some light, and then let the pigs do their thing. Their thing includes eating down the brush and rooting around in the stony ground, disturbing the soil in a way that induces the grass seed already present to germinate. Within several weeks, a lush stand of wild rye and foxtail emerges among the trees, and a savanna is born." Shady and cool, this looked like ideal habitat for the sunburn-prone pigs, who were avidly nosing through the tall grass and scratching their backs against the trees. There is something viscerally appealing about a savanna, with its pleasing balance of open grass and trees, and something profoundly heartening about the idea that, together, farmer and pigs could create such beauty here in the middle of a brushy second-growth forest. But Joel wasn't through counting the benefits of woodland to a farm. Idyllic pig habitat was the least of it. "There's not a spreadsheet in the world that can measure the value of maintaining forest on the northern slopes of a farm. Start with those trees easing the swirling of the air in the pastures. That might not seem like a big deal, but it reduces evaporation in the fields, which means more water for the grass. Plus, a grass plant burns up 15% of its calories just defying gravity, so if you can stop it from being wind-whipped, you greatly reduce the energy it uses keeping its photovoltaic array pointed toward the sun. More grass for the cows. That's the efficiency of a hedgerow surrounding a small field, something every farmer used to understand before fence row to fence row became USDA mantra. Then there is the water-holding capacity of trees," he explained, "which on a north slope literally pumps water uphill. Next was all the ways a forest multiplies a farm's biodiversity. More birds on a farm mean fewer insects, but most birds won't venture more than a couple hundred yards from the safety of cover. Like many species, their preferred habitat is the edge between forest and field. The biodiversity of the forest edge also helps control predators. As long as the weasels and coyotes have plenty of chipmunks and voles to eat, they're less likely to venture out and prey on the chickens." There was more. "On a steep northern slope, trees will produce much more biomass than will grass. We're growing carbon in the woods for the rest of the farm. Not just the firewood to keep us warm in the winter, but also the wood chips that go into making our compost. Making good compost depends on the proper ratio of carbon to nitrogen. The carbon is needed to lock down the more volatile nitrogen. It takes a lot of wood chips to compost chicken or rabbit waste.
So the carbon from the woodlots feeds the fields, finding its way into the grass and from there into the beef, which, it turns out, is not only grass-fed, but tree-fed as well. These woods represented a whole other order of complexity that I had failed to take into account. I realized that Joel didn't look at this land the same way I did, or had before this afternoon, as 100 acres of productive grassland patchworked into 450 acres of unproductive forest. It was all of a biological piece, the trees and the grasses and the animals, the wild and the domestic, all part of a single ecological system. By any conventional accounting, the forests here represented a waste of land that could be put to productive use. But if Joel were to cut down the trees to graze more cattle, as any conventional accounting would recommend, the system would no longer be quite as whole or as healthy as it is. You can't just do one thing. For some reason, the image that stuck with me from that day was that slender blade of grass in a too big, wind-whipped pasture, burning all those calories just to stand up straight and keep its chloroplasts aimed at the sun. I'd always thought of the trees and grasses as antagonists, another zero-sum deal in which the gain of the one entails the loss of the other. To a point, this is true. More grass means less forest. More forest, less grass. But either or is a construction more deeply woven into our culture than into nature, where even antagonists depend on one another and the liveliest places are the edges, the in-betweens or both-ands. So it is with the blade of grass and the adjacent forest, as indeed with all the species sharing this most complicated farm. Relations are what matter most, and the health of the cultivated turns on the health of the wild. Before I came to Polyface, I'd read a sentence of Joel's that in its diction had struck me as an awkward hybrid of the economic and the spiritual. I could see now how characteristic that mixing is, and that perhaps the sentence isn't so awkward after all. One of the greatest assets of a farm is the sheer ecstasy of life. Chapter 12. Slaughter. In a Glass Abattoir. Wednesday. Today promised not to be about the ecstasy of life on a farm. Today was the day we were processing broilers, or, to abandon euphemism, killing chickens. For all the considerable beauty I'd witnessed following a food chain in which the sun fed the grass the cattle the chickens, and the chickens us, there was one unavoidable link in that chain few would consider beautiful. The open-air processing shed out behind the Salatin's house where, 6 times a month in the course of a long morning, several hundred chickens are killed, scalded, plucked, and eviscerated. I said this link was unavoidable, but of course most of us, including most of the farmers who raise food animals, do our very best to avoid thinking about, let alone having anything directly to do with, their slaughter. "You have just dined," Emerson once wrote, "and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity." The killing of the animals we eat generally takes place behind high walls, well beyond our gaze or ken. Not here. Joel insists on slaughtering chickens on the farm, and would slaughter his beeves and hogs here too, if only the government would let him. Under an old federal exemption, farmers are still permitted to process a few thousand birds on farms, but most other food animals must be processed in a state or federally inspected facility. Joel's reasons for wanting to do this work here himself are economic, ecological, political, ethical, and even spiritual. "The way I produce a chicken is an extension of my worldview," he'd told me the first time we'd talked. By the end of the morning, I had a much better idea of what he meant. Wednesday morning, I managed to get up right on time, 5:30 a.m. to be exact, and to make my way to the broilers' pasture before the interns had finished chores. which today, in addition to watering, feeding, and moving the chickens, included catching and crating the 300 we planned to process immediately after breakfast. While we waited for Daniel to show up with the chicken crates, I helped Peter move pens, a two-man operation in which one man slides a customized, extra-wide hand truck beneath the pen's back edge, thereby raising it up on wheels, while the other grabs a broad loop of cable attached in front and slowly drags the pen forward onto fresh grass. The chickens, familiar with the daily drill, scooted along in step with their slowly moving mobile home. The pens were much heavier than they appeared, though, and it took every ounce of my strength to drag one a few feet across the uneven ground. Moving the broilers was not as easy as Joel had made it sound or the interns had made it look. But then, I wasn't 19 either. After a while, Daniel drove up on the tractor, towing a wagon piled high with plastic chicken crates. We stacked four of them in front of each of the pens housing the doomed birds, and then he and I got to work catching chickens. After lifting the top off the pen, Daniel used a big plywood paddle to crowd the birds into one corner so they'd be easier to catch. He reached in and grabbed a flapping bird by one leg and flipped it upside down, which seemed to settle it. Then, in a deft, practiced move, he switched the dangling bird from his right hand to his left, freeing his right hand to grab another. When he had five birds in one hand, I held open the crate door and he stuffed them in. He could fill a crate with 10 birds in less than a minute. "Your turn," Daniel said, nodding toward the cornered mass of feathers remaining in the pen. To me, the way he'd grabbed and flipped the chickens seemed unduly rough, their pencil legs so fragile-looking. Yet when I tried to coddle the birds as I grabbed them, they flapped around even more violently until I was forced to let go. This clearly wasn't going to work. So finally, I just reached into the flapping mass and blindly clutched at a leg with one hand and flipped it over. When I saw the chicken was none the worse for it, I switched it to my right hand. I'm a lefty, and went for a second and a third, until I had five chicken legs and a giant white pom-pom of feathers in my right hand. Daniel flipped open the lid on a crate, and I pushed the pom-pom in. I don't know if there is a more humane way to catch 300 chickens, but I could see why doing it as fast and as surely as possible was best for all concerned. Before we sat down to breakfast, scrambled polyface eggs and polyface bacon, Daniel turned on the gas under the scalding tank. The water had to reach 140 degrees before we could start. At breakfast, Joel talked a little about the importance of on-farm processing, not only to Polyface, but to the prospects for rebuilding a viable local food chain. To hear him describe it, what we were about to do, kill a bunch of chickens in the backyard, was nothing less than a political act. "When the USDA sees what we're doing here, they get weak in the knees," Joel said with a chuckle. "The inspectors take one look at our processing shed, and they don't know what to do with us. They'll tell me the regulations stipulate a processing facility must have impermeable white walls so they can be washed down between shifts. They'll quote me a rule that says all doors and windows must have screens. I point out we don't have any walls at all, not to mention doors and windows, because the best disinfectant in the world is fresh air and sunshine." Well, that really gets them scratching their heads. The problem with current food safety regulations, in Joel's view, is that they are one-size-fits-all rules designed to regulate giant slaughterhouses that are mindlessly applied to small farmers in such a way that before I can sell my neighbor a T-bone steak, I've got to wrap it up in $1 million worth of quintuple permitted processing plant. For example, federal rules stipulate that every processing facility have a bathroom for the exclusive use of the USDA inspector. Such regulations favor the biggest industrial meatpackers, who can spread the costs of compliance over the millions of animals they process every year, at the expense of artisanal enterprises like Polyface. The fact that Polyface can prove its chickens have much lower bacteria counts than supermarket chickens, Salatin's had them both tested by an independent lab, doesn't cut any mustard with the inspectors either. USDA regulations spell out precisely what sort of facility and system is permissible, but they don't set thresholds for foodborne pathogens. That would require the USDA to recall meat from packers who failed to meet the standards, something the USDA, incredibly, lacks the authority to do. I'd be happy to swab test my chickens for salmonella, listeria, campylobacter, you name it, but the USDA refuses to set any levels. As breakfast time conversation, the topic left a lot to be desired, but once Joel gets started on the government, there's no stopping him. Just tell me where the finish line is, and I'll figure out the best way to get there. The processing shed in question resembles a sort of outdoor kitchen on a concrete slab, protected from some of the elements by a sheet metal roof perched on locust posts. Arranged in an orderly horseshoe along the edge are stainless steel sinks and counters, a scalding tank, a feather-plucking machine, and a brace of metal cones to hold the birds upside down while they're being killed and bled out. It's not hard to see how a plein-air abattoir like this might give a USDA inspector conniptions. Make no mistake, we're in a war with the bureaucrats, who would like nothing better than to put us out of business. I couldn't tell whether Joel wasn't perhaps being a tad paranoid on this point. The pastoral idol has always felt itself besieged by malign outside forces, and on this farm that role is played by the government and the big processing companies whose interests they serve. Joel said state inspectors have tried to close down his chicken processing operation more than once, but so far he's managed to stave them off. It was a little early in the day for a full-blown prairie populist stem winder, but clearly I was going to get one anyway. The USDA is being used by the global corporate complex to impede the clean food movement. They aim to close down all but the biggest meat processors, and to do it in the name of biosecurity. Every government study to date has shown that the reasons we're having an epidemic of foodborne illness in this country is centralized production, centralized processing, and long-distance transportation of food. You would think, therefore, that they'd want to decentralize the food system, especially after 9/11. But no. They'd much rather just irradiate everything instead. By the time we finished breakfast, a couple of cars had pulled into the driveway. Two women from downstate who had read Pastured Poultry Profits and wanted to learn how to process the chickens they'd started, and a neighbor or two Joel sometimes hires when he needs extra hands on processing day. Joel had once told me he regarded the willingness of neighbors to work for a business as the true mark of its sustainability, that it operated on the proper scale socially and economically, as well as environmentally. That's another reason we don't raise 100,000 chickens. It's not just the land that couldn't take it, but the community too. We'd be processing 6 days a week, so we'd have to do what the industrial folks do. Bring in a bunch of migrant workers because no one around here would want to gut chickens every day. Scale makes all the difference. After a few minutes of neighborly chit-chat, everybody drifted toward their stations in the processing shed. I volunteered to join Daniel, the designated executioner, at the first station on the line. Why? Because I'd been dreading this event all week and wanted to get it over with. Nobody was insisting I personally slaughter a chicken, but I was curious to learn how it was done and to see if I could bring myself to do it. The more I'd learned about the food chain, the more obligated I felt to take a good, hard look at all of its parts. It seemed to me not too much to ask of a meat eater, which I was then and still am, that at least once in his life he takes some direct responsibility for the killing on which his meat eating depends. I stacked several chicken crates in the corner by the killing cones and, while Daniel sharpened his knives, began lifting chickens from the crates and placing them head first into the killing cones, which have an opening at the bottom for the chicken's head. Taking the squawking birds out of the crate was actually the hard part. As soon as they were snug in the cones, which kept their wings from flapping, the chickens fell silent. Once all 8 cones were loaded, Daniel reached underneath and took a chicken head between his first finger and thumb, holding it still. Gently he gave the head a quarter turn and then quickly drew his knife across the artery running alongside the bird's windpipe. A stream of blood erupted from the cut, pulsing slightly as it poured down into a metal gutter that funneled it into a bucket. Daniel explained that you wanted to sever only the artery, not the head, so that the heart would continue to beat and pump out the blood. The bird shuddered in its cone, its yellow feet dancing spastically. It was hard to watch. I told myself the spasms were involuntary, and they probably were. I told myself that the birds waiting their turn appeared to have no idea what was going on in the cone next to them. I told myself that their suffering, once their throats were slit, was brief. Yet it took several long minutes for the spasms to subside. Could they smell the blood on Daniel's hands? Recognize the knife? I have no idea, but the waiting birds did not seem panicked, and I took solace in their seeming obliviousness. Yet honestly, there wasn't much time for these reflections, because you're working on an assembly, or really disassembly line, and it has a rhythm of its own that soon overpowers your mind as well as your body. Within minutes, the first 8 chickens had been bled out and transferred to the scalding tank. Daniel was calling for 8 more, and I had to hustle so as not to fall behind. After I had loaded and he had slaughtered several batches, Daniel offered me his knife. He showed me how to hold the chicken's little head in a V between my thumb and forefinger, how to turn it to expose the artery and avoid the windpipe, and how to slice down toward you at a spot just beneath the skull. Since I am left-handed, every step had to be reverse-engineered, which tangled us in an excruciating moment of delay. I looked into the black eye of the chicken and, thankfully, saw nothing. Not a flicker of fear. Holding his head in my right hand, I drew the knife down the left side of the chicken's neck. I worried about not cutting hard enough, which would have prolonged the bird's suffering, but needn't have. The blade was sharp and sliced easily through the white feathers covering the bird's neck, which promptly blossomed a brilliant red. Before I could let go of the bird's suddenly limp head, my hand was painted in a gush of warm blood. Somehow, an errant droplet splattered the lens of my glasses, leaving a tiny, fogged red blot in my field of vision for the rest of the morning. Daniel voiced his approval of my technique and, noticing the drop of blood on my glasses, offered one last bit of advice. The first rule of chicken killing is that if you ever feel anything on your lip, you don't want to lick it off. Daniel smiled. He's been killing chickens since he was 10 years old and doesn't seem to mind it. Daniel gestured toward the next cone. I guess I wasn't done. In the end, I personally killed a dozen or so chickens before moving on to try another station. I got fairly good at it, though once or twice I sliced too deeply, nearly severing a whole head. After a while, the rhythm of the work took over from my misgivings, and I could kill without a thought to anything but my technique. I wasn't at it long enough for slaughtering chickens to become routine, but the work did begin to feel mechanical, and that feeling, perhaps more than any other, was disconcerting. How quickly you can get used to anything, especially when the people around you think nothing of it. In a way, the most morally troubling thing about killing chickens is that after a while, it is no longer morally troubling. When Daniel and I got ahead of the scalder, which could accommodate only a few birds at a time, I stepped away from the killing area for a break. Joel clapped me on the back for having taken my turn at the killing cones. I told him killing chickens wasn't something I would want to do every day. Nobody should, Joel said. That's why in the Bible the priests drew lots to determine who would conduct the ritual slaughter, and they rotated the job every month. Slaughter is dehumanizing work if you have to do it every day. Temple Grandin, the animal handling expert who's helped design many slaughterhouses, has written that it is not uncommon for full-time slaughterhouse workers to become sadistic. Processing but a few days a month means we can actually think about what we're doing, Joel said, and be as careful and humane as possible. I'd had enough of the killing station, so after my break I moved down the line. Once the birds were bled out and dead, Daniel handed them by their feet to Galen, who dropped them into the scalder, a tub outfitted with moving shelves that plunged the birds up and down in the hot water to loosen their feathers. They came out of the scalder looking very dead and soaked, floppy wet rags with beaks and feet. Next, they went into the plucker, a stainless steel cylinder that resembles a top-loading washing machine with dozens of black rubber fingers projecting from the sides. As the chickens spin at high speed, they flop and jostle against the stiff fingers, which pull their feathers off. After a few minutes, they emerge as naked as supermarket broilers. This is the moment the chickens passed over from looking like dead animals to looking like food. Peter pulled the birds from the plucker, yanked off the heads, and cut off the feet before passing the birds to Galen for gutting. I joined him at his station, and he showed me what to do. Where to make the incision with your knife, how to reach your hand into the cavity without tearing too much skin, and how to keep the digestive tract intact as you pull the handful of warm viscera from the belly. As the viscera spilled out onto the stainless steel counter, he named the parts. Gullet, gizzard, gallbladder, which you must be careful not to pierce, liver, heart, lungs, and intestines. Have to be careful here again. Then he showed me which organs to keep for sale and which ones to drop in the gut bucket at our feet. The viscera were unexpectedly beautiful, glistening in a whole palette of slightly electric colors, from the steely blue striations of the heart muscle to the sleek milk chocolate liver to the dull mustard of the gallbladder. I was curious to see the gizzard, the stomach-like organ where a chicken uses bits of ingested grit to crush its food after it's passed down the gullet. I slid open the tight, hard nut of gizzard and there inside found tiny pieces of stone and a blade of bright green grass folded like an accordion. I couldn't make out any insects in the gizzard, but its contents recapitulated the polyphase food chain, pasture on its way to becoming meat. I didn't get very good at evisceration. My clumsy hands tore unacceptably large openings in the skin, giving my chickens a ragged appearance, and I accidentally broke a gallbladder, spilling a thin yellow bile that I then had to painstakingly rinse off the carcass. After you gut a few thousand chickens, Galen said dryly after I'd torn another chicken, you'll either get really good at it or you'll stop gutting chickens. Galen had clearly gotten really good at it, and he seemed to enjoy the work. Everybody was making desultory conversation as they went about their jobs, and the morning had something of the flavor that I imagine a barn raising or a November session of corn shucking once had. People who ordinarily work alone having a chance to visit with one another while getting something useful done. Much of the work was messy and unpleasant, but it did allow for conversation, and you weren't going to be at it long enough to get bored or sore. And by the end of the morning, you had something to show for it, and a great deal more than you would have had you been working alone. We hadn't been at it much more than 3 hours before there were 300 or so chickens floating in the big steel tank of iced water. Each of them had made the transition from clucking animal to oven-ready roaster, from killing cone to holding tank, in 10 minutes, give or take. While we were cleaning up, scrubbing the blood off the tables and hosing down the floor, customers began arriving to pick up their chickens. This was when I began to appreciate what a morally powerful idea an open-air abattoir is. Polyface's customers know to come after noon on a chicken day, but there's nothing to prevent them from showing up earlier and watching their dinner being killed. Indeed, customers are welcome to watch, and occasionally one does. More than any USDA rule or regulation, this transparency is their best assurance that the meat they're buying has been humanely and cleanly processed. You can't regulate integrity, Joel is fond of saying. The only genuine accountability comes from a producer's relationship with his or her customers, and their freedom to come out to the farm, poke around, sniff around. If after seeing how we do things they want to buy food from us, that should be none of the government's business. Like fresh air and sunshine, Joel believes transparency is a more powerful disinfectant than any regulation or technology. It is a compelling idea. Imagine if the walls of every slaughterhouse and animal factory were as transparent as polyfaces. If not open to the air, then at least made of glass. So much of what happens behind those walls, the cruelty, the carelessness, the filth, would simply have to stop. The customers pick their chicken out of the tank and bag it themselves before putting it on the scale in the shop next door to the processing shed. Having customers bag their own chickens preserves the fiction that they're not buying a processed food product, which is illegal in an area zoned for agriculture. Rather, they're buying the live bird, which Polyface has slaughtered and cleaned as a courtesy. If you buy one at the farm, a Polyface chicken costs $2.05 a pound, compared to $1.29 at the local supermarket. To keep that premium as low as possible is yet another reason for processing on the farm. Having to take